This week on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, we're joined by Luis Martinez for an in-depth discussion on the complex and pressing issues facing Venezuela and the broader region. Mr. Martinez serves as a Hispanic liaison and spokesperson overseeing Spanish language media relations and translating key city communications to enhance Hispanic community engagement at multiple programs and services. In addition, this is an interview you don't want to miss. Don't miss it airing on all platforms. Follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you find your podcast. And please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss the conversation.
All right, welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I am honored and privileged to have a great conversation this morning with one and only Mr. Luis Martinez. As Venezuela enters a dramatic new phase that could reshape the politics of the Western Hemisphere, there's the one and only Mr. Luis Martinez. He's a veteran political commentator with NTD TV, born and raised in Venezuela, and specializing in Latin America, American geopolitics, including Cuba's influence and authoritarian survival strategies. Martinez can provide clarity and context on a crisis that is fast evolving and widely misunderstood, and that is a mouthful. Welcome to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. Mr. Martinez, how are you?
Good morning, Earl. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's begin at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Luis Martinez.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, I was born and raised in Venezuela. I grew up in the 90s in Caracas, the capital city. And I remember my childhood, you know, Venezuela was the promised land. The future was bright and beautiful and nothing to worry about. Everything was going well for the country, lots of opportunities. And then when I turned into my teens, the dictatorship started going full throttle. That's when I got involved in politics back home. I was part of the first generation student movement against the dictatorship, first fighting educational reform, then fighting constitutional reform, then media takeover. And by the time I graduated high school, I was under surveillance by the government, and my parents made the decision that I should go study abroad until things quieted down for a bit. And I thought that was just going to be 4 years and I'd be back in my home country. When I left, Earl, I was part of a student movement that had 11 coordinators in the capital city. By the time I graduated college, seven of them had been in prison, two of them had been killed, and two of us were lucky to have left and found refuge here in the United States. Ever since, I've been in different media outlets and different institutions trying to explain the Venezuelan situation, the impact that it has to U.S. national security, and of course, how it has destabilized the entire region. I lived for 10 years in Panama. I also lived in the United Kingdom, and now I'm based in Washington, D.C., very lucky to be back in the U.S. and covering Congress for NTD TV. Last week, for example, Earl, I was very lucky, one of those things that, you know, how life puts you in those situations, to meet again with Mayra Corina Machado when she visited the Senate and had a meeting with a bipartisan group of senators. I followed her all my life. I've met her on several points of my life, whether during protests on the streets in Caracas or different meetings here in Washington, D.C., and now Nobel Peace Prize winner and hopefully future presidential candidate in elections that we hope to see in Venezuela in the near future.
So let me ask you, I'm a 71-year-old American who I remember when I was a young man reading about Hugo Chavez and him nationalizing the oil in Venezuela and Venezuela having some of the sweetest crude oil. Crude of any other nation on earth. And I think the other one was Libya with Muammar Gaddafi. So I remember reading about those people and that they were using the financial resources of that crude to uplift the lives of the citizens. What happened?
Well, that's a lot of rhetoric. And yes, it's true. Hugo Chavez won the 1998 elections, promising to take back control of the Venezuelan oil industry so that the profits of Venezuelan oil could end up benefiting Venezuelans. But the truth is that what Hugo Chavez did was nationalize the oil industry and govern over the period with the highest oil prices in the history of Venezuela. So when Hugo Chavez came into power, the barrel of Venezuelan oil was about $20 per barrel. By 2005, it had risen to $110, $115 per barrel of Venezuelan oil. So we had the largest influx of money into the country. The government of Hugo Chavez, that quickly became a dictatorship, used a lot of that to finance social and welfare programs. But the truth is, Earl, that these programs were never meant to actually benefit the people, but to buy votes. And the truth is that what happened was that the national oil industry was underinvested and brought down to a ruin, and once oil prices tumbled after the end of the long wars in the Middle East, the government was left without any money to finance the social welfare program. So yes, maybe for a good 5-6 years, Venezuelans did see higher access to education, higher access to health, and different, you know, water and infrastructure projects in popular neighborhoods in overcrowded cities. But by the time Hugo Chavez died in 2013 and Nicolas Maduro took over as his handpicked successor, Venezuela saw inflation rates of over 7,000%, to the point that for long periods of time, we're talking years, supermarkets were completely empty. I had my own parents, lawyers, professionals in Venezuela be unable to access basic foods. The country was eating just lentils and whatever staple they could find in the supermarket, because everything that was nationalized ended up being destroyed through underinvestment and poor mismanagement. So there was a lot of rhetoric, and unfortunately, because Hugo Chavez died and Nicolas Maduro is the new popular name of the dictator that ran over Venezuela, people forget that it was Hugo Chavez, the original sin, and he has been martyrized in Venezuelans' memories, and a lot of left-leaning and socialists in Latin America still believe that Hugo Chavez was this bright, shining light that promised the socialism of 21st century, which actually did not bring benefit or put an end to inequality in Latin America, actually exacerbated through mismanagement.
So you spoke of the barrel of oil being $22 and then going up to 115. That had a lot to do with the Arab oil embargo. I mean, certainly that wasn't something that you can blame on Hugo Chavez or Venezuela. That was an issue that caused mayhem and pain all over the world.
Yeah, the oil prices went up, and also because of the Iraq war and U.S. foreign interventions in the Middle East that you know, sort of created this cycle where oil prices went up. But the problem that a lot of oil-rich countries in the Middle East, and Venezuela and Latin America and Burma in Southeast Asia, is that these governments rely too much on oil profits in order to govern. And that's just, as we've seen, a poor strategy, because you are then at the mercy of oil prices, and OPEC hasn't been able to control them because there's other players in the world stage. And I think Venezuela was actually the one who started this whole chapter of resource nationalism back in the 70s, when it was a Venezuelan oil minister that traveled to the Middle East to propose the creation of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, now known as a cartel that pretty much manages and tries to keep oil prices at levels that benefit their countries, not necessarily that benefit the world economy.
So let me ask you, how is it possible that the American oil companies got control over the oil fields in Venezuela?
Well, it was actually American oil companies that started the oil industry in Venezuela. I think the first oil well that was found in Venezuela or deposit was back in 1928. And soon after, it was American companies came into the country and started building the infrastructure to actually extract oil from Venezuela and obviously sell it in the international market. Now, in the 50s, we had a military dictatorship, Marcos Perez Jimenez, who created a law of hydrocarbon law to invite foreign companies to invest and grow the Venezuelan oil industry. So it wasn't Venezuelan ingenuity or Venezuelan knowledge that kickstarted the Venezuelan oil company. Before the entry of American companies, Venezuela was a rural and agricultural nation with a very small population. And it was only after oil was found in Venezuela that the Venezuelan government opened up its immigration laws to invite Americans and Europeans to move, to the point that in the 50s, a third of the population was foreign-born and then just became assimilated into Venezuelan society. And as I mentioned, then came Hugo Chavez, who nationalized the oil industry and pretty much flipped over the status quo, having the government be the one to manage how oil companies could operate in Venezuela and the margins that they could extract from those operations.
So is there any truth to one of the reasons why Chavez was able to come in and do the things that he did is because even though the American oil companies were there, the people of Venezuela weren't benefiting by it. And so in comes Hugo Chavez, who says, I'm going to change all that. I'm going to nationalize the oil, and you're going to benefit from it. And that's why the Venezuelan people agree with him.
Yeah. So in the 80s and 90s, corruption, lower prices of oil, had Venezuela had a decline in its growth, and the populations who had all emigrated to the big cities, expecting jobs, expecting access to universities, were left empty-handed. So there was a resentment towards the status quo. It was two main political parties, Acción Democrática and COPEI, that were not delivering as they had been promised, and everything started being blamed on government corruption and inefficiency. So there was some truth, and that's how Hugo Chavez got elected in 1998. But let's not forget that Hugo Chavez, a former army officer, attempted a coup in 1992. And that, to a lot of Venezuelans who did not support Hugo Chavez in the 98 election, was problematic, because how can you elect someone who had decided to take up arms against the government, against constitutional order, and actually murdered Venezuelans, to then actually have him elected through democratic means? But you know, that's history. He was elected with 56% of support in 1998. But most political analysts and historians would say that every election after 2002 in Venezuela was manipulated and or stolen by the regime.
So I think it's important, as an American citizen and many people in this nation who will be listening to this podcast and don't have the knowledge base that you have about Venezuela, I think it's critically important that we have this conversation, because people woke up one morning, I don't know, about a month ago, and all of a sudden we're invading the nation. And not to mention, you know, doing some horrific things without the American people even understanding why. We have a major flotilla that caused billions and billions of dollars to maintain, sitting over outside of, you know, Venezuela. And so people asking the questions, why are we there? Can you give us an educated rationale other than we're there to stop the drug dealing?
Yeah, and I think that President Trump did not do himself any favors by the way he expresses himself, because one day he was talking about fentanyl and fentanyl wasn't coming out of Venezuela. And another day he was talking about drug trafficking, which is true. There's a third of the cocaine that leaves South America goes through Venezuela. But then he also mentioned oil. But the thing is, the Venezuelan case is multifaceted and very complex. So first of all, and this is from since 2002, you had Cuban counterintelligence agents pretty much running the security apparatus in Venezuela. This was first rumored for a very long time, and after Operation Absolute Resolve, it was beyond proven and actually admitted by the Cuban regime that 32 of their counterintelligence officers were the most inner protection circle guarding Nicolas Maduro. So you had, you know, communist Cuban regime pretty much calling the shots of a security apparatus in a Latin American country rich in oil. Venezuela, since Hugo Chavez got elected, also financed the campaigns of Evo Morales from the movement towards socialism in Bolivia, Cristina, and the Kirchners, who were two presidents in a couple who were presidents in Argentina, also financed part of Lula's campaign. So this was Venezuela became a very important actor in Latin American geopolitics. Then you have the Chinese Communist Party also coming in and setting up all the surveillance, technological surveillance state for the Venezuelan regime, starting from even IDs with Chinese chips that were meant to track how Venezuelan citizens voted in elections and whether or not they had access to certain welfare programs. Then you also had Iran and Lebanese nationals tied with Hezbollah received passports from the Venezuelan regime, about 2,500 to 5,000 Iranian and Lebanese nationals with links to terrorist organizations from the Middle East receiving passports and were walking around South America as Venezuelan citizens and operating freely. And then, Earl, you had the economic mismanagement of the country of 30 million people that caused one third of the population to emigrate and pretty much collapse social services all around Latin America, with about 786,000 Venezuelans coming to the U.S. But that's pretty much one of the countries that receives the least Venezuelans. Colombia has over 3 million Venezuelans. Peru has over 1.5 million Venezuelans. And again, this destabilizes the region. And lastly, but not least importantly, the Venezuelan regime started to find new ways to make money for its lackeys and for its security forces through the armed forces. And that's what we've heard so much from President Trump and the Trump administration. They started what they call the Cartel of the Suns, which was they used the Venezuelan armed forces to facilitate drug exports of cocaine being produced in Colombia, trafficked through Venezuela, and exported to North Africa and Europe and the United States. Just a little bit of context for your audience. It's called the Cartel of the Suns because Venezuelan generals have in their lapels suns, the sun insignia, and as many suns as they have, it's if they're higher ranked or lower ranked. So it's called the Cartel of the Suns because it was the Venezuelan generals running it. So you have this one country in the hemisphere that is bringing in foreign terrorists, has close ties to the most important rival in great power competition to the United States, which is the Chinese Communist Party, has Cuban intelligence agents running the security for the regime, and is causing mass migration and making drug cartels be able to operate freely through their territory. So when you pile all of those things together, that's the case for bringing one third of the U.S. Navy into the Caribbean and end up executing Operation Absolute Resolve. And I think that the Trump administration had a lot of issues in explaining all of this and putting it together, and it just sort of came out the days previous to the operation as a whim from the president to take out a dictator in the region, when it's actually something very comprehensive and tied to the new national security strategy of the United States in the Western Hemisphere.
So as an American citizen of 71 years, what I'll say to you is, There are nations all over the earth that have similar situations going mm-hmm. on, and we're not there. Mm-hmm. And so to say that this was something that was imminent, as you stated, Venezuela is a very small nation. What it has going for itself is its crude oil, its oil reserve. It's sitting on it has the sweetest crude oil in the world. People in the know are aware of that, because what's been happening in Venezuela didn't just start happening, and it didn't just have to be resolved because a new president decided to, who's only been in office a year, decided to fix all of the things that you are talking about. And so for some of us, we don't think that the response inside of a year, and that this was had to be done right at this moment, and with all the other things that are going on in the world, and especially in our own nation, the explanation, if you will, doesn't fit. Again, moving as many military pieces as we moved over into that area, because who and what are we protecting? It's not the Venezuelan people. We didn't do this for the Venezuelan people. Your thoughts?
No, I mean, if you ask Venezuelans, especially in the U.S., and who have lived the experience, none of us are upset about what happened. Many of us are very thankful and celebrating that a dictator has been removed. And I understand your point, and the point that a lot of people make. Like, there's other regimes around the world that are as troublesome, and the U.S. is not just swooping in and taking out their president or trying to change the regime's attitudes towards the United States. I think the Venezuelan case is a very specific case. And if you look at the history, modern history of the United States, and when they've apprehended heads of state or legitimate or illegitimate leaders of other countries, three out of the seven cases happen to be in this hemisphere. There's Manuel Noriega in Panama, Aristide in Haiti, and now Nicolás Maduro.
I know them well.
Yeah, and now Nicolás Maduro in Venezuela. Now, again, this is... we're living in a time where geopolitics is a very complex chessboard. I would also put in the table that unlocking the Venezuelan political gridlock, allowing for U.S. companies to come in and reinvest in its oil industry, will tumble oil prices worldwide by increasing the output. And when that happens, what do you see as a consequence? You see regimes as the Russian regime and the Iranian regime unable to profit as much from illegal oil sales as they are right now. So I think that the move and the timing has to do with the more complex global geopolitics. And in this case, if you want to force the Russians to some sort of peace settlement or ceasefire in Ukraine, you have to hurt their economy as much as you can. That's the only way that that Putin will be stopped, because clearly he doesn't care about how many people, how many Russians are killed in the process. And in Iran is the same. They clearly don't care how many civilians that they have to gun down in the streets. But if they can't pay their generals, they can't finance their corruption, then those regimes would tumble. So I think that unlocking Venezuela and taking action, and it's true, like, why now? Why this president? Because the Biden administration was the one who indicted Maduro, but never put enough pressure to do something as we're seeing right now. And I think it has to do with the rest of the geopolitical context. And let's not forget, 80% of Venezuelan illegal oil sales, well, illegal because they were sanctioned by the United States, were going to China, which is the U.S.'s main geopolitical rival, who is benefiting from receiving really cheap oil from Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. Now, that's not something that if you're competing with someone, you don't want to see them get cheap oil in detriment to your own economy. So the reasoning behind, I think, extends beyond the Western Hemisphere, although going in now does help U.S. interests in the region and national security in the Western Hemisphere.
So, Mr. Martinez, let me push back a little bit because, again, what it appears from my limited knowledge of what is transpiring is many of those who have been displaced in Venezuela, middle class and upper class Venezuelans who have left Venezuela and migrated to America and other nations, wanted to see this movement take place because they want Venezuela to go back to what it was and what it could possibly be, and they wanted to go back home. And they brought pressure on the now president, Donald Trump. They couldn't bring that pressure on then President Joe Biden. And so now this was imminent. This had to be done now. As an American citizen, sir, I don't see why this had to be done now. Again, the fact that we've got all of that military might over there and our nation that is struggling itself economically, the American people are struggling. Many Americans are not being able to feed themselves and having trouble here at home. To say that this is being done and it had to be done now, I push back on that because it didn't have to be done now. It was done now for political reasons. All of this is all about geopolitics, as you stated, because we're now under the current president moving away from what we've done over the last 50, 70 years, being concerned about what happened in the East, and now we're pushing everything towards being concerned about what's going on in the West. Your thoughts?
No, I completely agree. It didn't have to happen. But the strategies that the previous administrations had entertained vis-a-vis Venezuela, pressure, sanctions, negotiations, weren't working. And I think President Trump, whether you agree with him or not, is changing U.S. foreign policy. And this goes in line with what he's at least spelled out to be his idea of a foreign policy, of a more, I guess, America first agenda, pushing back against the so-called international rules-based order and pushing for American interests first. And I do think, I would agree with you, Earl, that it was done for political reasons. I think that if things go well with the influx of American oil companies investing in Venezuela, you might see significant economic benefit for the U.S. before President Trump's term ends in office. Term in office ends, and then he will be able to say, like, "Hey, like, look, I promised and I did this." So obviously, there's political motivations. I think that's also the name of the game. Every president in elections and for their party will try and do that. It is definitely something very different that we've seen from the past, not without precedent, as I mentioned with Manuel Noriega and Aristide in Haiti. My final thought on that pushback is that, yeah, it didn't have to happen. Personally, as a Venezuelan, I'm happy it happened. I think it allows for the Venezuelan people to now have a different option for the future. And we'll see how the Trump administration's negotiations with the interim president go, because at the end of the day, it could also turn up terribly like it did in Burma, where the military took over and jailed the Nobel Peace Prize winner. Maybe Delcy Rodriguez would actually end up being worse than Nicolas Maduro. We'll see how that turns out. But yes, Earl, it wasn't an imperative for the Trump administration, but it was a clear, he's been signaling since day one when he started naming cartels foreign terrorist organizations, and then including Tren de Aragua, and then including the Cartel of the Suns, and then doubling up the reward for Nicolas Maduro. So he spent the first 12 months of his presidency signaling to the Venezuelan regime, you should change your attitudes towards us or something will happen. And it happened.
So the operative word is if. It's, you know, two letters, but in this instance, it's a big if. And again, the money that's being invested in moving that military might over to the West, and again, when the American people here are struggling themselves, I would say to you, sir, you know, this could end up terribly. And there is no guarantee. I don't know how the Venezuelan people feel about what is transpiring right now. We don't hear much from the Venezuelan people who are there. We hear from the Venezuelan people who are no longer in Venezuela. We hear from you guys, but the people who are still in Venezuela, we're not hearing much from them, except for I've you know, read some things about the fact that they are not happy with what has transpired, and they're kind of like in limbo. Here the United States is doing some things that I don't know, that I believe clearly unright, pirating, you know, oil, you know, ships and doing all sorts of things that aren't benefiting the Venezuelan people. So how are they better off now that Maduro's not there? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, before Operation Absolute Resolve, there was no hope for any future change. The Venezuelans have been rising up in protests for years and being gunned down and imprisoned by the regime with pretty much no way of changing the political status quo. Last year, 2024, Venezuelans had elections. They elected overwhelmingly, because the ballots show that's more than 78%. 78% of people who came out in an election fearing for political persecution voted for the opposition leader who's now been exiled for fears of being jailed by the regime. So the Venezuelan people want change. They've proven that they want change for over 20 years. So I in turn will push back in saying that the Venezuelan people are not happy. My family's still there. They're happy. And in general, now they have an option for the future. Yes, right now, they 15 or so, because it was January 3rd when this happened. There's not going to be an immediate impact on Venezuelans' pockets or wallets or way of life. But what they do know is that Delcy Rodriguez has been following to the letter what the U.S. government has been demanding from her. She is already saying she's going to change the hydrocarbon law to allow for American oil investment. She's already taking out of government ministers that were lackeys of Nicolas Maduro and believed to be his private financiers. And they've already started releasing political prisoners Again, these were people that have been jailed in torture centers just because of their political opposition to the regime. So there is some immediate impact, and it's going to be in the medium and long term that we will see whether this will help the Venezuelan people or not. I personally am very confident that is the beginning of the reconstruction of the country.
Do you believe that the Venezuelan people are happy with the president of the United States saying we're running Venezuela? Do you think that the people in Venezuela, in replacing Maduro, have a president of the United States of America saying we're going to control their finances, we're going to do all these things? I don't know. I'm not there, but I venture to say that there are probably more Venezuelans who aren't happy to hear that than there are to say that that's okay.
Well, I don't think any Venezuelan believes that President Trump is now ruling over Venezuela.
No, but he's saying that publicly.
Right. Well, yes.
Okay. Right. I'm not defending, I know we can only go by what he's saying, right? Publicly. Yeah,
I'm not defending the world. President Trump. He is a character that is known for making hyperbole a common use, and I think that's the detriment of his objectives and what his administration might want to do. And he often overspeaks. I think he also posted a picture of a Wikipedia page placing himself as the president of Venezuela. This is all, of course, distasteful, and you wouldn't want, as anyone from the international community who looks up to the United States as a beacon of democracy, it's definitely not something you want to see from a president of the United States. I think at the end of the day, the Venezuelan people don't eat of speeches of democracy. They don't eat out of political propaganda. They eat out of the reality of their lives. And right now, it's less than $1 a month, the minimum wage in Venezuela, when we used to be one of the richest countries in the world. So they are, as you mentioned, in a limbo because we don't know exactly what's going to happen. What we do know is that it's something different than what has been happening under the regime for the last 20 years. And I would put it also on the table that Venezuela is in Libya. Venezuela is in Iraq or Afghanistan. This is a Western-oriented country in the Western Hemisphere with long, long cultural ties to the U.S. to the point that Venezuela's national sport is baseball because of the American oil companies that came in early 20th century. And we're pretty good at it, actually. Like, there's a lot of Venezuelans in the Major League Baseball. So, like, the cultural similarities, the fact that we're not a divided country of different ethnic groups of different religions, 94% Catholic, will make the Venezuelan case very different. And I will go back to Panama. If we want to look at any example of what would one think is a horrible U.S. intervention into the sovereignty of a nation in the Western Hemisphere, Panama got his. The president also, during Operation Just Cause, was imprisoned and taken to federal prison here in the United States. And what happened to Panama? It had over 10% growth rate for almost 20 years and now is a shining beacon in Central America, inviting investment and being the center for business and logistics and travel in Latin America. So I think that the president would show that there's a bright future for Venezuela. I will not put aside your concerns, Earl, that this is not the way the U.S. has conducted itself during the past 57 years. And yes, there's been a change in U.S. foreign policy regarding a rules-based order. And the President of the United States is a character that has continued to make use of hyperbole and insults and a language not befitting the office of the presidency. I don't think Venezuelans are spending their time thinking about Trump's rhetoric. They're thinking about their individual well-being and the future of their country. And hopefully the change in regime or forcing the regime to change will bring benefits to Venezuelans. And in turn, I also hope that this operation benefits U.S. national interests.
So, I mean, there's a much bigger nation that's not so far away that is going through similar issues, protests. It's called Iran. And people are in the streets and people are being slaughtered and people are dying by the thousands. And yet we haven't moved on that. And so this is why people ask the question, you know, if at the root of this is the fact that people are being mistreated and people don't live in a democratic environment, and that's why we had to move and do this in Venezuela, then it's pretty easy to ask the question, if that was the reason and the rationale because of the mistreatment of the Venezuelan people. There are many more people in Iran, and they're going through similar issues. Why didn't we move on that?
Well, I think the Trump administration made it clear that their intentions had very little to do with the Venezuelan people. I think democracy was mentioned zero times during the press conference of January 3rd
because of what you just said, doesn't have anything to do with democracy. That's the reason why many Americans are asking the question, sir. If it doesn't have anything to do with the Venezuelan people and democracy, then you got to ask the question, then what are we doing?
Well, okay, so to the why Iran not, it's because it's a completely different scenario, and I'll touch on that in a second. But it's not about democracy in Venezuela. As I mentioned, it had to do with oil. It had to do with drugs. It had to do with Chinese, Russian, and Iranian influence through Venezuela in Latin America. And it had to do with an immigration crisis that was destabilizing the region. It didn't have to do with democracy in Venezuela, to the point that that's not what the Trump administration is demanding. It's not demanding that Maria Corina Machado, the Venezuelan opposition leader, be installed as leader. And they're not demanding free and fair elections tomorrow or next month. They just want the political stabilization of a country in their quote-unquote neighborhood in the Western Hemisphere so it stops being a threat to U.S. national security. Iran, on the other hand, is a very complex situation. It's not the Venezuela. We saw the Venezuelan armed forces were unable to put any sort of resistance to the American armed forces.
They're a flea. America's an elephant, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, but the Venezuelan people, that's a flea.
Iran's a different animal altogether. We have seen that Iran has been able to retaliate. It actually fired missiles at the Al Udeid base in Qatar. It fired on Israel and actually caused some damage in Tel Aviv and other big cities and penetrated the Iron Dome. It has a very professional Revolutionary Guard. It has proxies with Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis. It's a very different government.
They're not much of a threat to the most powerful nation on earth. Come on.
They are a threat to U.S. interests around the world. They're a threat to Western Europe. They're a threat to Israel and to U.S. quote-unquote hegemony over this quote-unquote international rules-based order. So the reason why one would argue like, oh, you intervened in Venezuela, why don't you intervene in Iran? It's a completely different case, completely different animal to face, and not as directly tied to U.S. national security interests. And I think that if we go back to December of 2025, when the Trump administration released its national security strategy for the next year, it clearly shows that the U.S. is trying to focus again solely on the Western Hemisphere. And that's why they're pushing so hard back against NATO and having NATO pretty much pick up their own bill when it comes to defense. And that's why they're having incredible language concerning Greenland, because they're focusing on the Western Hemisphere and the movement of the one-third of the naval fleet to the Caribbean. Yes, it comes to a great cost, but as far as some leaked documents we've seen, Earl, they're going to stay in that area of operation for years to come. So I think it's just a general pivot of the national security strategy. We'll see if the next administration continues the course or ends up being something that was a costly adventurism from the Trump administration.
You know, Mr. Martinez, I'm really enjoying our conversation. You bring a wealth of knowledge and history and all of those things to the table, but clearly, when we look at this thing as American citizens, and the president who almost thought he was going to get carte blanche from all the oil companies to come in and do this, realistically, you know, he's got three additional years. And this movement that he's made to refurbish the machinery to get the oil out of the ground in Venezuela, it's going to take more than 3 years. It's going to take over 10 years. So it's a long-term plan that a lame duck president can't, his policies will be dismissed by others if the Democrats win and they come into power. All that's going to be erased. So it's a long shot. And so many of the oil barons have said, we're not going to do it. We're not going to get engaged. We're not going to get involved in that because, you know, it's a slippery slope. So what happens then if what many people think is going to happen, a change in administration in the next 3 years, the oil barons who would be doing the investment in that aren't going to run the risk of, you know, this, because it's a long range plan. Now what happens to Venezuela?
Here's my cynical take on that argument, Earl, and I completely agree with the fact that, hey, 3 years' time, odds are any betting man would say a Democratic president is going to win the White House after the trauma of a Trump presidency. And we also would probably make good money if we bet on Democrats winning back the House, the midterm elections in 2026. But from all those oil executives, we only really saw pushback from ExxonMobil saying that Venezuela is uninvestable because of the political instability and the lack of guarantees and security guarantees for oil companies to go in. I read that as Exxon trying to negotiate a better hand, a better maybe reimbursement from the government on their investment. But we've already seen three European oil companies apply for licenses to extract oil in Venezuela. And we saw all the rest of the American oil companies in that meeting with the president say that they're willing to put money down. And that is because within 18 months to 24 months, that's about 2 years of proper investment, you can double the output of Venezuelan oil. And this is, as you say, an opportunity that is too big to miss out from the oil executive. So my cynical view on why would a Democratic president or a Democratic Congress continue policies that the Trump administration started, my cynical view is that a lot of those candidates, including the next Democratic presidential candidate, will receive a lot of campaign financing from these big oil companies to keep those policies in place because it benefits them.
So politics.
And we know how politics works, Earl. I don't think it's far-fetched to think that it would work, because at the end of the day, most people's ideas are up for sale to the highest bidder and not necessarily principled politicians. And I don't mean no insult to anyone. It's just the way of the world. So I would imagine that by 2028, if this experiment is starting to produce benefits and real revenue for oil companies, we'll see them invest and lobbying and putting ads on to show that this was good for the American people. And if we see oil prices at the gas pump go even further down, that will make a stronger case for politicians to at least keep the plan of having American oil companies go into Venezuela in place.
You're very well versed, and I will say to you, sir, that if we, you know, America is the number one producer of oil right now as we speak, but we clearly don't have the long-term resources that Venezuela has. And that's why for so many decades and the American people, the American power brokers would not drill our oil because we've got a limited amount of oil in the ground. And Venezuela clearly has the most. Mm-hmm. But I was asked you, prior to President Trump becoming the president, there was a push for doing away and getting away from oil. And mm-hmm. and so that we were going to change, we were in the process of changing energy in this country and different parts of the world. Are you concerned at all that we're going to go back to green energy once Donald Trump is gone, and these oil barons who are now still maybe believing, some of them, that we're going to go back, turn back to page? Or are you, some of them are hesitant because they know we're turning back to page when we're talking about drilling for oil, when the rest of the world and others are pushing for something that is much cleaner, a cleaner way of energy?
Definitely in American politics, since Trump got into the White House for his second term, politicians right and left, and I would focus more on left, have waned off of climate issues, have waned off of green energy issues, because it doesn't seem to be popular. It doesn't seem to be sticking with voters. And also, I'm assuming that the investments are not going that way, so it's not beneficial for politicians either to double down on that messaging. I think also, so far, the technology and the supply chains for creating this new green energy infrastructure in the United States are still not in place to make it as exciting as to incentivize people to go back to that political rhetoric. So I don't see, and this is with other issues, I don't see certain left-sponsored issues coming back to the fray midterms 2026 or presidential elections 2028. I think the Democratic Party has also learned the lesson that affordability is going to be the way to go for the next 2 years. And we saw that the Chinese have already had such an advantage when it comes to these energies and technologies, and they control the supply chains. You can't build solar energy or wind energy in the United States without going through Chinese companies. That this also goes into the geopolitical competition aspect of things. While U.S. oil companies do have an advantage worldwide in their know-how and the ability to deploy resources. And as you mentioned, yes, Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world, over 303,000 million barrels of crude oil, and the U.S. has most of the refineries in the world that are able to process Venezuelan crude oil. So why not exploit that that comparative advantage with your competition? And Europe, yes, they're continuing their Green New Deal ways, but they're their economy is actually stifling, and their innovation is also not where patents are being made now in Europe. It's actually China that is now surpassing the EU when it comes to new patents and new technologies. So I don't see green energy being at the top of political issues in the near future.
You're a very bright man. I'm sure you don't dismiss the science that has been proven with the impact of us doing business the way we've done business in the past. Long term, we know it's been proven that this is not good for the planet, is not good at all for the future of mankind. Do you dismiss those things or as folly?
Not at all. You know, there's something that whenever I have a conversation with my father about the future of the world, and he's very frustrated when things don't go well, which is quite often, if not always, I always tell him, hey, in politics, the good guys never win. What you get is the lesser of,
that's
of
true.
Evils.
That's true.
The lesser of evils. So that's not the name of the game. Unfortunately, government, politics, world affairs, this is not about what's right and wrong, but the best possible outcome with all the interests that are in the way and all the different power factions, right? And democracy still delivers the best way for the less powerful powerful to actually contest power and get things to change. So no, I do not dismiss the science behind global warming. It is a concern. I think that it would have to then come from the private sector. And I think there's a lot of things that could be done also with social issues that people can take power back from government with their own decisions in how they consume and make choices in the market on an everyday basis. Because again, when it comes to politics, rarely does the right idea or the right thing happen. It's always interests that are involved.
You know, sir, I use a term called politricks and politricksters. And you just did the best job of explaining why. Because what is right doesn't come into play. No. And so if that's the case, and we know it is, we've got to fix that. It can't be accepted that right is not going to win out. Okay? And at the root of all of this is for mankind. I don't care. We're talking about mankind. We're talking about humanity. We got to fix this politics thing. It can't be right is not going to win out.
Well, I think at the end of the day, we need to
For those of us
who think that there is a correct way forward and that politics is not delivering, we need to tune our messaging. We need to do a better job at mobilizing people. Because again, I do believe democracy works, or at least it gives people the best shot at contesting existing power structures. It has happened in the past. We have, like, if we look at history from a broader perspective. Especially U.S. history, democracy has delivered changes that were unimaginable 40 years ago, unimaginable 100 years ago, and so forth. So, you know, not lose faith in the process, get better at messaging. I think that the new technologies have created a new problem for democracy and the communication of ideas, because now we have this ginormous platforms that are able to influence people's minds in ways that we still haven't been able to push back. I think that mainstream media is seeing a challenge by all these smaller outlets and voices, but then these smaller voices don't necessarily have the structure to actually deliver impartial news or information. But I believe that the process will end up working for truth, because at the end of the day, no matter how long the time frames that we're looking at, truth will always win over.
Mr. Martinez, I want to thank you from the depths of my heart for accepting the invitation. You've been even better than I thought. Really appreciate it, and hopefully we've been able to garner some information to people in this nation who probably wouldn't get it anywhere else. So thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule, and hopefully we'll cross paths again in the future.
Of course. Thank you so much, Earl, and enjoy the conversation. And I think that's the way forward. We need to talk to each other to get to the bottom of things and find a better way forward.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a great day.
You too.
That's a wrap.